This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to take up a very, very important topic. Because we often hear of the anti-inflammatory diet. That's a term that has made its way into the lexicon these days. And today we're going to talk to a very, very important person in the development of this concept. In fact, he is the individual who first christened the anti-inflammatory diet as such. It dates back to an article that he wrote way back in 2002, which was entitled "The Diet-Induced Pro-Inflammatory State, a Cause of Chronic Pain and Other Degenerative Diseases." And it was a clarion call to change our diets, because our diets matter when it comes to the risk of inflammation. And so he's written a book called The D-Flame Diet, and he's going to tell us all about it. Dr. Seaman was, as I say, the first person to author a scientific paper that specifically hypothesized that diets can be pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory. He is a 1982 graduate of Rutgers University. He received a Doctor of Chiropractic degree from New York Chiropractic College. And he received a master's degree in biology and nutrition from the University of Bridgeport. So his efforts in educating his fellow professionals and the public resulted in his being named 2006 Academician of the Year by the American Chiropractic Association. So it's a pleasure having you here on Intelligent Medicine. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Doc. Appreciate it.
So first of all, give us a little bit of a definition here, because why should it matter? Let's put it this way. Why should it matter what we eat when it comes to the end result? What are the various disorders that may be related to an inflammatory state?
Well, if we think about the conditions that people suffer from as they age, and we look at, like, say, the three biggies, which would be at least the three biggies in my mind that has stood out over the years, would be heart disease, cancer, and then those are the two biggies, and then Alzheimer's disease became another one where people more frequently have seen their witnessed their parents and all the people in their family kind of just deteriorate as they age. And you know, no one really understood what that meant or how it worked, and they used to use the word dementia. And they start looking into the chemistry of Alzheimer's disease, and basically the chemistry of Alzheimer's disease is essentially atherosclerosis or heart disease in terms of chemistry in the brain. People often will say diabetes in the brain, but diabetes, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, if you look at the chemistry of each condition, they're essentially identical. And we get there by gradually increasing our inflammatory state as we age, and we do it in four main ways. Mm-hmm. One is by eating, I kid around them because to try to make it less stressful, because people get so stressed out about food. It's such an emotional topic. So I call it being like a dietary crackhead, where we just eat too much sugar and flour and donuts and pretzels and the like. And I call it a drive-by self-shooting, where people just drive into fast food restaurants in the parking lot and sort of mindlessly over-order hundreds, if not thousands, of calories, depending upon what they're feeling like. So we do this over time, year after year, and of course the years fly by. And then we stress out, we don't sleep, we don't exercise, and we gain weight as we age. The average person weighs 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds more if they're in their 50s compared to when they were in college.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 25 years of flaming, as I call it, by those four main lifestyle choices, lifestyle factors, lack of sleep, stressing, lack of exercise, and overeating. And nobody overeats too much salad. So we know what the overeating is, and it's not because of meat. To blame meat is ridiculous, because the lion's share of calories that the average person eats comes from sugar, flour, and then the oils that they're cooked in.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's, I think, an important point, because meat is often fingered as the culprit in inflammation, that it's pro-inflammatory, perhaps because it contains saturated fat and cholesterol. But how is it that you arrived at the formulation that meat is off the hook in terms of promoting inflammation? It's such a commonly held notion.
It's amazing, actually. And what's really interesting is that people need to, you know, think about what cattle are fed. They're fed basically, you know, lots of stuff, but corn would be like mm-hmm. pounds and tons of corn. So these are vegetarians. They're eating corn, and they become obese. Right. So when you eat this obese meat, people, as opposed to thinking, well, what got the cow to be obese if it's a standard feedlot animal? Well, they ate too much corn. Well, what happens if we eat too much corn? The average person is not going to eat your corn, but it's the excess carbohydrate and the associated lipid that's eaten with it, and so that fattens us up. And so if someone eats zero saturated fat and they only eat cookies with no fat, so it's just sugar and flour, when we overeat those calories, we will increase our cholesterol level, we will increase our circulating triglyceride levels, and we'll increase our circulating fatty acid levels. And that's by not eating saturated fat. But because we're animals, we, like the cattle, convert our excess carbohydrate calories into cholesterol and triglycerides.
Mm-hmm. Is there something to
So it can't be meat. It can't be meat if the same bad obesity issue and cardiovascular disease issue occurs in animals that are overfed, a non-meat diet.
Mm-hmm. Is there something to the notion that you are what you eat eats? Because some people have pointed to the potential for feedlot-fed animals to maybe have the wrong fatty acid composition that they, by virtue of the fact that they consume a lot of corn, for example, as a feed, that they have more omega-6 and less omega-3 as primitive, you know, paleo antelope had, for example, or what were our pre-human forebears used to eat prior to domestication of animals.
Yeah, I think that's probably an issue, but I think it's a minor issue compared to the abundance of calories that we eat from sugar, flour, and refined oils, which is, I mean, in my book, I say 60%, but that's just an easy number to remember. Some people are absolutely at 60, some are over, but it's actually like 56% of the average American's calories comes from sugar, flour, and refined oils. You take those calories away and you replace them with vegetation, and if you're eating feedlot animal products, I don't think the fatty acid profile will make a difference in that context. I think it becomes cumulative when you consider all the rest of the stuff that people are consuming, which again is the sugar, flour, and refined oils. And the problem with that is that we develop not a true addiction, but we have a withdrawal type response if we don't get those foods. We crave those foods because of the way they taste and the fact that they do stimulate addiction neurocircuitry in our brains. So we kind of crave those foods. So people, it's really kind of a scapegoat scenario when we blame meat, even though the saturated fatty acids are elevated a little bit too compared to normal or wild game. But even if the omega-6s are a bit elevated, I don't think that would make that much of a difference. And I know this just because of when people have deflamed their diet and I don't make an issue of of the meat sources, because for certain people it's just too stressful to make the sugar flour change.
And it's really expensive sometimes to, you know, buy organic grass-fed steak, for example.
Right.
I just went to Whole Foods and got myself a porterhouse steak, and it was $30.
It's crazy.
You know, I could go to Sizzler and get a steak for cheaper. Of course, it would be conventional meat.
Yeah. Well, my brother was we're 2 years apart, so we're both late 50s, mid late. He'd say he's mid 50s. I'm like 57, so I'm like I'm getting ready for 60. So he's mid 50. I'm like accepting 60 is my next big number. He probably weighed, we're same height, 6'2". He probably was pushing 230 or so. He dropped 50 pounds, but as a guy who weighed 230, whenever he would work on his property and rehab stuff, he'd have aches and pains from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. He had adult onset asthma and just kind of felt miserable. So he just got rid of the sugar flour calories, and he lives in Missouri in a small town of 1,000 people. And so he just bought meat and grilled it and chicken from the local store. And I didn't say anything about the grass-fed stuff just because why burden him with that idea, because stress would be a problem. He shredded down to about 175, 180, and his aches and pains went away, and his adult-onset asthma is now gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's eating.
This is a point worthwhile making, is that some people believe that it's inevitable that we become progressively more inflamed. I mean, you know, it's kind of the mating call of the 55-year-old is, it's getting up off the couch.
Yeah. Well, I would say that in general, and, you know, this is, you know, again, looking, I realize now for sure that I have less years to live than I've already lived. And so as I age, and as you age, everyone else ages who's listening or not listening, part of the aging process, it's a low-grade pro-inflammatory state aging itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we're all going to go at some point. But the idea is to, and there's actually a scientist put the term inflammaging into the literature.
Very good.
So the idea is to anti-inflammage rather than pro-inflammage. So we're going to inflame no matter what, but the idea is to flame gracefully and not be riddled with and stricken by a chronic inflammatory disease that cuts our life short, cuts our enjoyment of life short, and really hurts us financially.
Well, there are certain objective criteria that you can evaluate food on. You can measure their nutritional value. You can decide their proportions of macronutrients, protein, carbohydrates, and fats. You can measure their calories. But how do you determine the, I guess I'd use the term inflammagenicity of, or the inflammatory potential of foods? Has anybody published an evaluation of that? Is there such a metric? And did you use that in your hierarchy of anti-inflammatory and pro-inflammatory foods in the book?
No, I tried to keep it really, really practical in terms of because when someone's flaming away with food, and because food is so emotional and eating is such an emotional issue, that anything that's more stressful just makes it worse. So my message in the book is, get rid of your sugar, flour, and refined oil calories. And the perfect example of that would be French fries and donuts. Get rid of those until you weigh what you weighed before the body fat started to accumulate. And that means for most of us, to even though I'm not a big fan of Ansel Keys, the lipid hypothesis guy who basically started the problem, he did say some really accurate things back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and that was, you know, we should all be weighing what we weighed when we were 25 or younger, assuming we were normal weight then. And the average person is, again, 10, 20, 30, really 40 or 50 pounds more now, like in my age group, because I look at people on, since the whole Facebook thing kicked in, I probably went on there maybe in 2009, and I was, I didn't recognize a lot of people.
Keep track of your high school classmates that way, right?
Yeah, you know, yeah, that too, absolutely. So when I looked at those pro-inflammatory calories, so let's just say that somebody is Nordic, and they just have a preference, so they live in, say, Wisconsin, and they have a preference for fatty fish, fatty meat, and cheese. Well, okay, well, eat mostly, eat those calories, but weigh what you weigh when you were in college, assuming that was your proper weight, and the rest of your calories should be vegetables, and you should be fine, because you can go live in the Arctic Circle during the winter on mostly a fat diet. You know, Stefansson basically went up there. He lived there for like 9 years back around 1900, and ate only meat for almost 9 years straight. No weight gain, no cardiovascular disease. So if that's your preference, you can do that if you want. I mean, I favor more vegetation, but if you preference that, not a big deal. And then you can go to, say, Okinawa. And if you look at Okinawa, you say, oh, well, rice. Nah, Okinawa.
It's primarily a vegetarian
the lion's
diet
share
and fish.
Yeah, and, but it's their unique purple sweet potato is the primary calorie source in the Okinawan diet. And then if you go down to the South Sea Islands, the Solomon Sea, that area there, like near Catawba, which is part of New Guinea, the lion's share of their calories, again, sweet potatoes that they grow. So sweet potatoes, yams, and taro root, and their next calorie source that is, at least by weight, is fruit. So like things like papayas and guavas and such. Mm-hmm. So here is a sweet potato and papaya diet, and they are not stricken with cardiovascular disease, diabetes, heart disease, or cancer, or Alzheimer's. People live to be in their 90s, and they're free of disease. They just go by, you know, the weight, well, just age. But totally different, where it's mostly carbohydrate, potatoes and fruit, versus mostly walrus meat way in the Arctic Circle, and they have similar lifespans. So what's similar about them? No sugar, no flour, no refined oils, and they're active throughout their life.
Mm-hmm. And this sounds a little bit akin to the paleo diet, which is, depending on your interpretation of where your ancestors were from, might vary in the amount of carbohydrates, the proportions of meat to vegetables, and so on. But it's mostly defined by the absence of modern processed domesticated foods.
That is the problem. And the whole paleo diet thing, too, I've known Lauren Cordain for, I don't know, probably since 2002, or maybe 2000 even. And there has been, I call it sort of like a co-opting of the paleo plan, because the paleo diet initially was more of like a research concept, where a researcher brought it into the public's awareness back in 2002 when Cordain published his first The Paleo Diet book. And then it became like everything became paleo. And these non-scientists who have bachelor's degrees or whatever, they become the paleo experts, and they make it like a low carb only, high meat diet.
Yeah.
When that would be true if you're in the Arctic Circle, but not if you're in Okinawa, not if you're in New Guinea. So they really screwed up the message, which is why I like the deflame diet or anti-inflammatory diet, because it speaks to eat whatever foods you like, so long as your measurement markers like waist hip ratio, BMI are all appropriate, your blood glucose is appropriate, your CRP is appropriate. It doesn't really make any difference
what you eat, so long as you eat. If you might pause, CRP is one of the best ways that we can ascertain your level of inflammation, right? It's a simple blood test. It can easily be ordered. Tell us about
that. Well, it's interesting. When I graduated from chiropractic college in 1986, the only CRP that was available, so I'm sure it was probably some of you at med school, the only CRP available was basically, it was lined up with ESR, exercise sedimentation rates. And those
I
guys only show positive.
I committee to reelect the president. That was Nixon, I think, the Nixon campaign, if you remember that far back. And CRP was right.
Well, you know, I was born in 60, so back then it's kind of like, I don't remember that. But I remember the other stuff that happened with Nixon. But CRP, though, Well, CRP back then, it didn't show up as being positive unless it hit 10. And
they developed the high sensitivity. That's ridiculous, because by the time your CRP is 10, you're pretty cooked, right?
Yeah, you're cooked. But it was only, I think it was maybe the mid-late 90s when they developed the high sensitivity CRP that can be measured below 1.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we know that anything really above 1 means you got the low-grade flame going on.
Mm-hmm. And that's, so that should be our goal, is to get it down to 1 or 0.5 when you're using the highly sensitive C-reactive protein, right?
Right, that's below more, one should be the goal. Or you know, one or less, absolutely.
More discriminating yeah. measure. And actually, it's been suggested that compared to cholesterol measurement, you know, you could see people with low cholesterol and even decent ratios get heart attacks all the time. It's thought that highly sensitive C-reactive protein greater than 2 is a more predictive marker than high cholesterol for cardiovascular risk. So clearly, inflammation is the basis for so many of the degenerative diseases, whether it's brain, heart, joints, you know, blood vessels, kidneys, you name it.
Yeah, it is actually shocking how low-grade inflammation really is the issue. And when you look at whether one goes to, well, any healthcare profession school, they still get taught standard physiology. They don't get the proper integration of the most current research on chronic inflammatory states in the context of lifestyle when they're looking at treating disease. You can hear still people say, well, besides your cancer, you're really healthy. Wait a second.
Yeah, right.
You got cancer. You can't be really healthy besides your cancer. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Well,
but CRP, though...
We know the role that inflammation plays in cancer, because a clear-cut example of which is patients who have ulcerative colitis, which is an inflammatory condition of the intestine. We may keep their inflammation at bay, and they may not have to run to the bathroom 10 times a day, but if they have low-grade smoldering colitis 10 or 20 or 30 years, hence they may develop colon cancer. That's why they're subject to more colonoscopies, because they need closer surveillance. And similarly, you know, what smoking does to the lungs, and so on and so on. It's inflammation is implicated in so many cancers.
Yeah, it's hard to actually pick a condition that that isn't driven by inflammation. So I'm not sure if your audience, I know certainly you are, prostaglandin E2 and
yeah.
how PGE2 is produced from arachidonic acid, which we get in our diet either preformed in animals that have lived on corn, or we get it through our corn oils and safflower and sunflower oil. The bogusly referred to vegetable oils, I mean, safflower seeds is not a vegetable. I mean, they're not a vegetable. So it's like some inappropriate word signaling when we use the word vegetable oil. I mean, there is no broccoli oil, but these are omega-6 rich oils, and they become PGE2. And PGE2 is a pro-inflammatory prostaglandin, and it pushes expression of most conditions, including cancer. One of the interesting things I learned, I don't know, I forget how long ago it was, but a lot of women get their BRCA, the BRCA gene, checked, because if you're positive, which means it's not working, then you're more likely to develop breast cancer. Only about 5% of women who get breast cancer actually have the mutation.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is that PGE2 that we get from our diet actually turns inhibits the inhibitor area of the gene associated with the production of estrogen. It's called, you know, it's the aromatase gene. And so when aromatase turns on, you make more estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, well, then you're more likely to get these estrogen-mediated diseases.
So it was just a double negative. If you inhibit the inhibition, you get more. You get more estrogen. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So aromatase needs to be inhibited. And
mm-hmm.
BRCA is the inhibitor.
Okay.
But if you inhibit BRCA, now you get more estrogen.
Okay, got it.
And so every time someone does a drive-by self-shooting and eats French fries, they're taking in the omega-6s that creates more PGE2 eventually, and that leads to can lead to the functional inhibition of BRCA.
Hmm, okay. So,
isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I think another way to look at it is that some women, you know, have prophylactic mastectomies, prophylactic oophorectomies based on genetic testing. And what they don't realize is that it certainly puts you at higher risk of cancer if you have these genes, but it's not inevitable. And lifestyle measures can mitigate your risk. So, you know, what you just described is how a dietary factor can have an impact on what appears to be a fatal genetic flaw. It doesn't predetermine entirely your risk of cancer.
Oh, exactly. But it's interesting, though, only 5% roughly of all women with breast cancer have the mutation, mm-hmm. which then gets back to lifestyle. And the biggest issue, the biggest drivers of cancer is hyperglycemia, and so the overeating of sugar and flour, mm-hmm. and then too much omega-6s. Those guys get jacked up, and you just start to push chronic inflammatory expression across the board. And if you're genetically disposed to cancer, you're probably going to turn that on.
Okay, this is a good point in which to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. When we return, more on the subject of inflammation, we're talking to the author of The Deflame Diet and one of the originators of the term anti-inflammatory diet based on a scientific paper he wrote way back in 2002. He's Dr. David Seaman, that's S-E-A-M-A-N, and we'll be right back with more of Intelligent Medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.